got a great film to play next.
Hello.
Have you ever snubbed a lady?
We had a technical problem.
Are we on?
Yeah. We're on there.
Can I swear? Shit!
Welcome to Crunch and Roll, which is a podcast about the side of the radio industry that most people never hear about, featuring some of its most interesting characters. My name is John Fox, and I've presented the Odd Breakfast Show here and there around the country over the last couple of decades, although my guest today didn't realise that I was that John Fox who used to do the Breakfast Show on BR&B. Not awkward at all, but don't worry, I didn't let him forget it. Mike Toolan doesn't really need an introduction, but I am contractually obliged to do one, so here we go. He's probably one of the best-known names in the industry, but there's plenty in here that you almost certainly don't know. Like how he freaked somebody out on air one day that they brought a gun into the studio, how he was sacked for getting someone to say bum, and how he felt when he was replaced by JK and Joel on the Key Breakfast Show. Oh, and somebody, please write him a Wikipedia page. Now, before we start, just our little reminder that if you enjoy this podcast and you are a regular listener, or maybe you're listening for the first time, actually, we would be eternally grateful if you could support us on Ko-fi. Just go to ko-fi.com/crunchandroll. And as always, thank you very much to everybody that has supported us so far. We love you. Right, let's get Toolanized. Let's crunch and roll.
Oh, yeah.
Mike, how are you?
Mate, I'm really sorry. I'm just midway through my Coke Zero. I'm great. How are you, Foxy? It's great to be on.
No, thank you so much. It's lovely to see your face, of which you've never seen mine before. We were just discussing this before we hit record.
Listen, I've never seen your face, but I've heard your voice. I've been listening to Crunch and Roll. It must be a couple of years now. And to be honest, I was getting marginally paranoid because you seem to have every single one of my friends in the industry, whether it's Steph Hurst or Scott Makin, Simon Ross, Emma Scott, Daryl Denham, they've all been on. And I was beginning to think, when's he going to ask me?
Well, here you are. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Because you are a regular to Crunch and Roll, Mike, you'll know by now that our research can be sketchy. So please forgive me if any of this is wrong, and just correct me, okay?
That's fine. Okay, mate.
But I never... You're from Essex.
I am. I grew up in a town in Essex called Chelmsford. And I don't know if there's some sort of, you know, sort of sexy core to the universe. I think Chelmsford is probably the furthest point from it. But it had Essex Radio, which was back in those days, and you'll probably remember Foxy, or you know, a lot of the guys listening to this will, you know, back in the days when each area just had one radio station and it was massive. And Essex Radio, you know, was literally the big station for Essex. And it was, you had Capital Radio in London, Essex Radio in Essex. And there was a guy on the late night phoning called Timbo, who was just, you know, a legend. And he had all that kind of anarchic stuff that I guess Steve Wright did, maybe even before Steve Wright, with the, you know, the big wacky jingles and the crazy characters and the phone-ins. It was proper late night radio. And it was that thing, like, you know, so many people on this podcast have sort of related to, where you know, everyone at school back in the day would have talked about what was on the Timbo show the night before. And I just loved it. And then they somehow did auditions for three people to help him out on his Saturday show, which was a show called the Saturday Whatnot. And I auditioned for it and I got a job as one of the Saturday Whatnotters.
Saturday Whatnotters.
I know. It sounds a bit naff now. It was the 80s, Foxy. It seemed to work.
So what did you do as a whatnotter?
Well, as a whatnotter, my duties consisted, we used to go out and record vox pops with people about, you know, whatever the big news topic was that day. We'd read out dedications. We'd do a what's on guide, you know, all that sort of local radio 1980s stuff that everybody did. But we were only, you know, there was three of us, and I think we were between about 11 and 13 years old at the time. So it was just nuts. Monday to Friday, I was at school, and then on Saturday, I was doing the radio. And then as soon as I think the very first time I heard that whoosh of the airlock door, and I saw that first red light come on, I thought, oh my God, this is me. This is, and I was sold. And I didn't just want to listen to radio. I just wanted to be in it. And God, 120 years on, here I still am.
Do you know what, Mike? You've made me feel really tingly by describing that whoosh of the airlock door.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember that? There's that unique sound, isn't there?
Yeah, I'd forgotten that sound.
Yeah. And then the complete silence, except for some weird, inexplicable hum.
Well, you're bringing back all the happy memories, Mike, all the happy memories. So from there, I've got that you did hospital radio after that.
Well, I got fired from hospital radio. I did, yeah. I think it might have been, to date, one of the only places I've been fired from. I think it might be. I was on hospital radio Chelmsford. And again, the guys there were really, really lovely. But I think I made a woman say bum on air during a little sort of request. We had to go around the wards and collect all requests and stuff. And I had a microphone. I said, go on, love, say bum. She said, I've got a pain in him. I said, go on, say bum. And she lodged a complaint against me. Not for the first time in my career. So the bosses of it called me aside and they said, yeah, we don't think you're right for this. And I was like, oh, God, I've only been on here for about 4 weeks. So they let me go. I think they made some excuse about me being a bit too young. I think very much like Steph Hurst, I started at hospital radio before the official age. I think I was about 14 at the time. And yes, that was the end of my hospital radio career.
Is it true that you didn't do very well at your exam, so you went over to the United States?
Yeah, you're picking on all the low points of my life.
hey, Mike, really I've got you divorced out in the next half hour.
Oh, good, so. I can't wait for that one. Yes, no, I didn't do well enough in my exams. I've never been particularly academic. So when I got to the age of 19, me and a couple of mates, yeah, we went to America for a year, and this actually... Foxy, you'll remember, you know, the radio back in the 90s was like in America was just like next level. And they were doing all the stuff that even Capital hadn't sort of caught up with yet. So I was working on a building site in a place called Columbia in South Carolina. And it didn't suit me really, the world of building sites. You know, there were all these real macho alpha males, and there was me with my little dainty hands with no calluses. And we used to drive past a radio station called Yes 97 every day. And then one day I stopped off and I just had a little look around. I obviously had this big interest in radio and I stopped and had a little look around in reception. And there was one of the DJs there, a guy called Alan Chase, and the station was called WYYS Casey Columbia, Yes 97. And it was all that sort of stuff. And I had a chat with this guy. And as you know, the Americans love the English accent. And so they said, wow, you're English, man. Say tomato. And I said, tomato. And he said, say potato. And I'd be like, potato. And he loved it. And they loved my voice. So they put me on solely for that on a Saturday mid-morning with him on this massive big radio station. And I just nicked all of Steve Wright in the afternoons, God bless him, all of his sort of features. And I got the posse going and I had a Mr. Angry and all this sort of stuff. Because, of course, the internet at this point hadn't been invented. So I wasn't going to get caught. I actually did tell them as well that I was on the BBC in London. So I think I may have made out that I was Steve Wright. But I did. Before the internet, I lied and lied and lied. So my whole career is based on a lie. I gleaned my experience of doing a show properly for the first time in South Carolina.
Now, Mike, this is going to sound really strange, what I'm about to say. And forgive me, I am nowhere near being a stalker.
Go on.
But when I very first started in the industry back in 2000, I remember somebody, and forgive me, whoever that was, I can't remember, but they told me the story that you went to America and you told the radio station that you were on Radio 1, which is the reason why they gave you the show. Now, I am so grateful that you have confirmed that story is true, because I have shared that story so many times to other people.
Oh, bless you. Well, thank you for you know, even allowing me to tell it, if you've heard it already, John. That's 100% true. I worked for the BBC Radio 1 and I was their big afternoon star, and here are all my features. Another true story, and Mike and the Afternoon Posse. And I did it for a while, and I've still got some of the tapes, and I was awful. But then the good thing was I came back to the UK and I had all these tapes, and then I told all these program controllers that I was a big star in America. It's all a lie.
Have you passed this on to your kids?
I've tried to. I always say there's a phrase I heard years ago, which is so true. And I think if you've got a confident enough look and a towel under your arm, you can have a swim in any hotel pool in the world. And I've always managed to get away with that. There's been quite a few examples in my life of when I've done that. All I've got is, hey, here I am. Surely this must be okay.
Do you know one thing I've learned doing Crunch and Roll is that so many, like yourself, so many presenters had so much confidence. You know, Elliot Webb talked about the confidence at such a young age, and Rossi, Rick Horton, all these people, of course, you know. I mean, where did that confidence come from, do you think?
God, that's a good question. I don't know. My dad, who's no longer with us, was quite the storyteller. He was a Scouser, and he was quite the raconteur. And so, you know, I think I learned fairly early in life that trying to make people laugh might be a good thing. I wasn't particularly talented in. I'm not saying I can make people laugh now, by the way. I wasn't overly talented in any kind of other area. I wasn't particularly good at sport or anything, or particularly academic. So I just thought, wow, okay, so this might be the thing. Let's have a go at making people laugh. And then I suppose when it worked, I sort of gleaned confidence from that. But I think, yeah, it's always been a thing. I've always been a bit of a chancer. I think my one of my childhood heroes was Face Man from the A-Team.
Yes.
Do you remember him?
Yes, he's cool.
He was cool, wasn't he? Dirk Benedict, as I recall his actor name was. And I used to love the way he'd blag his way into any situation. He was always given the role of, getting all the spare parts that they could make a tank in half an hour. And I always did that sort of stuff. And when I was on this Saturday Whatnot, there was another guy called, you've mentioned before, a few people have mentioned on your podcast, actually, Foxy, a guy called Chris Farrell. And he was, he was at Heart for many years. He was at TFM. He was on Horizon, on Chilton. And he was another Saturday Whatnotter with me. So we started off together, and we're still best friends now, but we started off together. But he also used to work at, I think it was called Bush House, the World Service for the BBC in London. I think it was on Aldgate. And he was on a Saturday, he was a tape reclaimer. So if you remember all the old reel-to-reel tapes, and when they'd edit them, they'd throw the bits in the bin. It was his job to go in the bin and stick them all together again, which is quite possibly the most mundane job I think any human has ever had. But it gave him a BBC pass. So he had, at the age of 15 and 16, a BBC pass. And it meant that we could blag our way into Top of the Pops. So we did. On a Wednesday night, I was in Essex, so London and Shepherd's Bush was only half an hour away. And we used to go on a Wednesday night. You go, yeah, BBC, and you just walk straight in. And again, it's that thing about the towel and the hotel pool. We used to go and see Top of the Pops probably about once a month on a Wednesday night.
Love it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about when you come back to the UK, having spent time in the States. So you come back, as my research says here, to go to uni in Leeds.
Yes, that's correct.
What did you study at uni?
I started off doing maths, and then I thought, well, this is a bit hard.
Jesus.
I know. Can you imagine it? What did you study anything?
Yeah, I went to Lincoln Uni. I did media production, which I'm going to be honest, is on a par with Lego.
Mouse degree, isn't it? Mickey Mouse degree. No, that's good. Look at you. You've done it. You know, at least it was useful and it was vocational. I started doing maths, and then the tutor said to me, I don't think this is for you. So then I changed to business management and sociology. But while I was there, I started on, as so many of the guys on this podcast seem to have done, I started on MFM, so March of Sound. So I was on March of Sound with Chris Farrell. I think Greg Burns came after me, and Paul Griffiths, and there was a wonderful guy called Phil Roberts who did the breakfast show. In the early 90s, I started properly on MFM whilst being a student at Leeds at the same time.
Well, that means that our research is now scrapped because we haven't got MFM on there.
You've not got MFM?
No. Do you know, strangely, you're one of very few radio presenters who has not got a Wikipedia page. So our research is in the bin.
Really. Oh, right. Okay. I need to get on that.
You need to write it yourself.
I know. I mean, who normally writes these things? Is it the person?
Yeah, you know it is. When you read it, you know.
Yeah, of course it is. I've always felt it might be a little bit big-headed to write you. Mike did this and then Mike did that. I'm not entirely even comfortable talking to you about all this.
Bless you. So tell me about MFM. So how long did you spend at MFM?
I was at MFM for 3 months, and I did the evening show, and I could not believe it was just you'll probably remember, Foxy, from your first radio gig, you know, and everyone listening will remember that when you start on air and you open that mic fader for the first few times, it was mind blowing. I felt like I'd won the lottery. I couldn't believe I had my own proper radio show. I was only on it for 3 months over the summer, and then I had to start properly Leeds in I think the end of September. So I had about 3 or 4 months, and I'd handed my notice in, and they were very kind, and they said, "Do you want to stay on this evening show?" It was a guy, the boss was called Paul Mewis, who was a lovely man. And I said, "No, listen, I'm going to go and try and be a mathematician." But then shortly after I'd resigned, and Chris Farrell resigned as well. He was on the Drive Time show and we lived together. There was a wonderful fella called Owen. And I've never told this story before, and I need to apologize to Owen. Owen Lewis, his name was. And he did the overnight show, and he was a really sweet guy. But after one of my last shows, so I'd finish at midnight and he was on the overnights, me and Chris Farrell thought we'd play a little trick on him. And we actually hid in one of the spare studios when he was on air. And we put that studio on air as well. And we ducked down so he couldn't see us through the glass, through the window. And we started playing sound effects and just, you know, over the intros of his songs and when he was talking. So he was listening off FM, he'd hear in his cans, you know, like a horse going off or whatever it was, doors opening. And I thought he'd just laugh and say, "Oh, that's Toolan, where are you?" But it really freaked him out. And so much so, we felt too bad. We couldn't ever admit to it. And then he actually came in the next day with a gun. Because I've not mentioned this story in 20 years. But he actually came in the next day thinking that there was some sort of terror attack imminent. And he came in the next day with a gun thinking that someone was going to hack into the mainframe. And Paul Mewis, the program controller, found out eventually it was us, and he called us in his office and he said, "It's just as well you resigned, because if not, you'd be bloody fired." And I thought, "Okay, I'm so sorry." And so I left a bit of a negative footprint, I'm afraid, at Marcher Sound.
We're having a party.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so next I've got down Radio Air. You go to Radio Air next.
Yes, I did. Very quickly, I did bits of Radio City in Liverpool, which was my dad's hometown.
Yeah.
When I was a student at Leeds before I did Radio Air. And I did the weekend breakfast show on Radio Air. And again, amazing characters. Kev Seed was there and Tony Snell on breakfast. And it was brilliant. Tony McKenzie was the program director. And it was massive. 96.7 Radio City, or 96.7 City FM. In fact, Steph Hurst, who we've already mentioned, obviously, actually found my jingle. That's where I got my first ever jam jingle. And I was so excited, and she found it and sent it to me literally a week ago, and I've been playing it non-stop, just like the really cool character that I am. I did Radio City in Liverpool, which I loved, but very, very honored to be on there. Ever since a kid going to Liverpool, even pulling into Lime Street on the train, it used to say Radio City welcomes you to Liverpool, and it was like, wow. As a kid, I remember that, thinking, gosh, what a big thing that is. And then I did Radio Air. Yeah, I did Radio Air with again, and that's when I first met Steph Hurst, who was my producer on a Saturday show.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, Steph and I met in the early 90s, in the days of, you know, Kathy Dennis and East 17 and El Dorado on the TV.
Loved it.
Loved it.
So talk to me about your time at Radio Air. How was it for you?
It was great. I mean, Steph and I had a brilliant, brilliant show. She was my first ever producer. And like she mentioned on one of your previous Crunch and Rolls, she was probably 16 at the time. And I may have said slightly unkindly to her, "Listen, you're being a bit too keen." I mean, she was like a Labrador puppy. She was like, she'd just jump up and lick your face and play your jingles. But we just had the best. We had the best time on that show. And again, it was a real odd juxtaposition of me being a student at Leeds studying business management and sociology Monday to Friday. And then on a Thursday night, for example, Steph and I would go to the Town and Country Club in Leeds and interview in excess. And then that interview would go out on the show on Saturday. However it happened, and God bless Paul Fairburn for this, and Paul Stead, who was a brilliant guy there at the time in promotions, is now a big TV producer, I believe. We got all the big interviews. So we literally had, you know, Mariah Carey and INXS and people like that. And Steph Hurst has still got all the recordings. Take that, And we were the only people on the station who did interviews, because the guy on the breakfast show, who we won't talk about now, he didn't want to do them. So we did the big name interview. So it was just, it was bonkers, Foxy. I couldn't get over being a student. And on a Tuesday night, I'm interviewing, you know, take that backstage at the Brits. It was honestly as nuts as that. And I loved every minute of it.
So did you progress in Radio Air? Did you then go on to do daytimes and get a full-time gig?
I didn't work there when I finished being a student. So I was going to, and then I got a job offer at Rock FM in Preston and from a guy called Paul Jordan, who again was a lovely fella. So yes, I didn't progress to full-time daytimes on Radio Air. I went to Rock FM as my first job.
A lot of people talk about Rock, and I've got such amazing memories of that place. And I think there was a period of time, like there was at the station I started at in Hull. I'm not going to mention the names. It annoys people.
No, I don't think it does. Yeah, because you were on Viking for a while, weren't you?
You said it. Thank you, Mike. But I think you were at Rock FM when it was the glory days, the time where, you know, it was fun. You were encouraged to go out and get drunk. It was just an amazing time. Would you agree with that?
Oh, totally. Honestly, Foxy, I was so lucky. And all the guys listening to this, you know, you can probably remember, you know, the first full-time job you had. And it was just, I couldn't get over that I was doing it. And it probably still to this day, I mean, I had an amazing time on Key 103 and I love what I'm doing now still. But it was probably my favorite job. I was on Rock FM in the time. It was Simon Ross. And we're still really good pals now. It was Paul Jordan. It was Kev Seed again, Claire Anderson. The lineup was great, and we were all young, and we were all, you know, kind of guys or girls about town. We were all in our very early 20s, and we just absolutely embraced it. The station itself sounded really, really hot. It was it had all the I think WPLJ. So sorry about the Anorak reference. Center of the WPLJ jingles, 95.5, and all the big American jingles that I think only Capital at that time had. So all the sweepers and everything were all sort of like, you know, live from the top of the tower. From the top of the tower, you know, write it down. The station you listen to. It was all that JJ McKay stuff, which I know Steph Hurst and Rossi and many of us absolutely still get minorly aroused.
Yes,
by hearing. I'm sure you do. I mean, it was just a great time for radio, wasn't it? The mid-90s was just, it was a fantastic time.
So, I mean, you know, you're still fairly young in your career at this point as well. You must have felt like you'd won the lottery to be on a station like Rock at that time with those types of presenters.
I like to think I'm still fairly young in my career now, Foxy. but no, I was. Yeah, that was the first full-time thing, and there was no better station. I mean, I think someone said, I can't remember who it was now, but someone said on one of your podcasts a few months ago, you know, there was Radio City, which was doing incredibly well, obviously, and was a massive station for Liverpool. But Rock FM, it just thought bigger than it was. So essentially, it was Lancashire, but it didn't sound like it was Lancashire. You could listen in Manchester or Liverpool, and it sounded like the enormous, big powerhouse of a Northwest station. And it was brilliantly programmed by a guy, God bless him, he's no longer with us, called Jeff Graham, who I loved. And Paul Jordan was number two, as well as Breakfast. And Andy Roberts, of course, who went on to do loads of stuff for EMAP and Bauer, including running Kiss. Mm-hmm. Andy Roberts did the station sound, and it was just phenomenal. I mean, it was like the station I'd worked at in America. You know, it just sounded so big. Everything about it was just really hot rocking. Did I just say hot rocking?
You did.
I did, yeah. Oh, for God's sake, edit that bit out. But yeah, no, it was. And the people there were great as well. Even Sheila, the receptionist, I'm still friends with now. You know, everybody, Wayne, Eileen, all the people in sales and marketing, for whatever happened, it was just, for whatever reason, it was just everybody came together. And it was just one big sort of, you know, two-year piss fest. Everyone was just out having fun. And Preston, you know, with its Tokyo Joes and whatever, you know, you felt like you were a massive star at the time. I got my first ever. And a lot of the guys listening to this will relate to this. My first ever logoed car.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you ever have one of those?
I did. Yeah. I've told this story in one of the previous episodes, but I was a little bit embarrassed to have Foxy 96.9 Viking FM on the side of a BMW 1 Series. So I lent it to my mate, one of my best pals, who drove it to work. And he came to some traffic lights and he looked to his right and there was a school bus and everyone was calling him a wanker.
that's great. I bet you couldn't wait to get back in it. I had one that said, Mike Toulon on Rock FM, you've been Toulonized, which was the name of the wind-up feature we did at the time. And I didn't realize this was my first ever car, and it was a Ford Escort, but one of the cooler ones. And it was my first ever car. And I knew Rock FM was very big around Preston and Lancashire, but I'd never driven before. So I'd passed the test, but I wasn't an experienced driver. So everywhere I went, people would flash their lights at me. And I thought, wow. And I'd flash my lights back or give them the double thumbs. And I felt like a massive big star. God, I own this town. Everyone is flashing me. And about 6 months into owning this car, someone said, why haven't you turned the lights on? And I didn't. It's a true story. I didn't realize that the lights were on the side of the, there was a little switch, and I'd been driving around for 6 months with no lights, but at least I felt popular.
I love these stories. This is it's why true. We do this.
100% true.
So just forgive me. I've not said, what show did you do on Rock FM then, Mike?
I did mid mornings. Yeah. 9:30 to 12:30.
Cushy gig.
It's the best gig, isn't it? Mid-morning just the best?
All right, let's move on to the next station. So I've got in front of me that you went to BR&B.
I did, but there was a short spell at the wonderful TFM, where, of course,
really?
I bumped into and got to know the lovely Scott Makin, who was on this episode, who's on this podcast a few weeks ago. Yeah, lovely guy. He's got so many funny stories to tell, isn't he? I did a brief spell. There was a guy called Graham Ledger, who was the who was the program controller. And again, I keep mentioning him. Chris Farrell had gone to TFM, and there was, God bless him, Simon Nix was on Drive, and he was a lovely guy. There was Darren Daly, of course, you've had on, who was on the evening show at the time, Hits Not Homework. And I got offered breakfast on from Rock FM's mid-mornings. I got offered breakfast, so I left Rock FM to do TFM breakfast. But I wasn't there very long, which is something I always feel guilty about, because the people in Teesside were just the nicest. I lived in this little village called Bishopton, just outside of, it was between Stockton and Middlesbrough, and near Darlington, actually, it was. And it was like Trumpton, and everyone was so friendly. And again, just like Rock FM, everyone seemed to listen. And it was the wonderful days of radio, weren't they? But everyone seemed to listen to TFM. So I did the breakfast show for only about 6 months, but I absolutely loved it. And I was really sad to leave. Literally what happened was, about 6 weeks into me being there, I got a phone call. I think I just got my very first mobile phone, the Nokia 8210. And I got a phone call on it from a withheld number, and it was Clive Dickens. And he said, "Hello, mate." He said, "We've noticed that you've moved now from Rock FM. We were watching you." And I said, "Well, who's we? Who are you?" He said, "Me and Richard." And he won't thank me for doing that impression. And Richard Park at Capital and Clive Dickens, who was his number two, had noticed I'd gone, I don't know how, is it Extracts magazine or whatever it was in those days. They'd noticed I'd gone to TFM breakfast, and straight away, within a month of me being there, they were trying to get me out and get me to go to BR&B.
So you agree and you go to Birmingham. See, I genuinely didn't realize that you were part of BR&B's history. Can I ask a question, Mike? Did you get invited to the 50th anniversary of BR&B the other week?
You know, Foxy, I did. And I feel really bad, because initially I said, yes, I was going to go, and then I couldn't go. Then me and my daughter were booked to go on holiday. And I didn't want to cancel the holiday. I mean, I wanted to see the people at BR&B, but not enough to cancel a week in Mexico.
Not to make you feel any worse, but I didn't get an invite for that. So,
but were you at BR&B?
Right, Mike. This is
sorry. Hang on,
now, Mike. I would just. You've not done your research, have you? You should have done your research before this.
I should have done. I knew you were at Viking. I've heard you on Viking, but I didn't know you. When were you at BR&B?
So I was at BR&B for about 4 or 5 years doing the breakfast show. I was the final breakfast show on BR&B, and I was the first breakfast show on Free in Birmingham.
I knew that. I did know that.
Foxy, Mike Toulon, please.
No. Are we still friends?
Well, of course, we'll always be friends. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mate, I did know that. Of course I knew that. Sorry.
Edit that bit in, Simon.
Yeah, edit that. No, edit that out, Simon. Yes, of course. Well, you should have been invited, because you did breakfast for 4 or 5 years. You were the last person that closed down the station.
Well, I mean, so how long were you at BR&B for?
Again, not enormous amounts of time. I've sort of bounced around that, not as long as you. I was there. It was the summer of 96. And I was there. And again, I was really lucky. I think the same with Radio City and with Rock FM. I appear to have been there when the lineup was brilliant. So you had Les Ross, who I still think is probably the finest broadcaster, you know, in the UK. He's on Boom Radio now, isn't he? And he's doing a great job. And you had Phil Upton and Steve Priestley and Carlos. And Carl and Steve Priestley and I are still very, very close. I'm seeing Steve again in a couple of weeks' time. So, I mean, I absolutely loved it. It was a wonderful time for radio. And again, we had all these amazing, you know, big American jingles and probably like when you were there, the walk-up ramps, you know, that lasted for, you know, 2 minutes. And it was just... it was a massive, massive station. And I've always had imposter sort of syndrome. I couldn't believe I was actually on BRMB.
You know, it's funny. I think it's because I didn't realize that you were at all these stations for such a short period of time because you were at Key 103 for such a long time. Mm. I just imagined that you'd been at places for longer.
No, I don't think I did a year or so at Rock FM or a year and a half. And after that, it was always less than a year, I'm afraid. But it was a very quick and lucky hike up the career ladder. I mean, from the time I started working in 94 on Rock FM, 94, and by 97 I was on Capital in London. So yeah, I don't know how any of this has happened. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about Capital because that's the next move for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Richard Park, you know, and Clive Dickens, they obviously wanted you for Capital, but wanted to try you out on BRMB, I guess.
Yeah, maybe that was a thing. Yeah, maybe that was. And then Richard Park asked me to come down to the Euston Tower before we moved to Leicester Square. I think they were in the process of moving, and he called me down for a chat. And honestly, for me, that was it. I grew up listening to Capital, and it was like getting a number one record. That was the call I'd been waiting for, you know, my whole life. And suddenly, you know, there I was in the big league. And I remember at the time, I mean, you know, it was Pat Sharp and it was Dr. Fox and it was Chris Tarrant and Martin Collins, Mick Brown, Steve Penk, even Alan Fluff Freeman was still on Capital Gold. And I just remember walking up the spiral staircase and I had loads of photos of all the presenters and then including me. And I remember thinking, I'm the only one I haven't heard of. But yeah, no, it was just surreal. And Richard Park kind of, you know, took me under his wing. And they started me off by giving me a show called The Capital Countdown, which was a Saturday afternoon show. And I was supposed to play the top 40 records in London that week. But, you know, I'd done breakfast shows and, you know, I was more inclined to be a personality DJ than a chart show guy. So I started putting all these little features in there, which went down like a cup of cold sick with Richard. And I remember he called me into the office one day and he said, "Dear boy," as everyone on this show does the Richard part, "Dear boy," he said, it's the Capital Countdown, not the comedy countdown. And he just said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I heard you do a 3-minute link about you being in the bath." He said, "It's a fucking chart show." And I was like, "Oh, sorry, Richard." I said, "I thought you'd like it." And he said, "No." He said, "I think you'd be more suited to working somewhere else." And I said, "But I like it here." And then he, oddly enough, he was a bit cross with me, but in the very same meeting, you know, there's always high drama with Richard. In the very same meeting, he said, "Well, look, you're clearly not a chart show guy." And I thought, oh my God, I'm being fired. I knew I should have kept that bathtub linked to 2 minutes. And he said, "So listen, I'm going to offer you early breakfast." And I was like, "What?" And Richard Allinson, who'd done it, you know, since the beginning of time, was leaving. And so he offered me the early breakfast show pre-Tarrant, which for me, you know, I grew up, you know, listening to Tarrant in the morning on Capital and then, you know, Steve Wright in the afternoon on the way home, God bless him. And that I could not believe I was handing over to Chris Tarrant. And Tarrant massively took me under his wing and we went to Australia together on an OB and he put me on his show. He put me on the Capital Breakfast Show. I was his little Keith Chegwin runaround boy. And he'd be like, "Okay, the London Marathon this weekend. Let's cross now live to where it was. Let's cross to Hyde Park. Hello, Tools. How's it looking, Tooley boy?" And I'd be, oh, hi, Chris, I'm here with all the runners. But, you know, and I'd do all that sort of OB, all that cheesy OB stuff. So I was Tarrant's whipping boy on the Capital Breakfast Show, which was still the biggest show in Europe, I think it was at the time.
Is it true that you went to Parky and you asked for a better show?
Yes, that's really good. How did you know that?
We speak to certain people. Yeah,
I did. I said I did it for about, again, maybe a year and a half or 2 years. And I said, and we had a meeting. And well, actually, the meeting didn't start off very well. I just split up with my girlfriend at the time. And she'd moved out. And I was having a bad week. And then Richard called me in. And I think we, Heart FM in London, 106.2, had got its stuff together really quite well. And I think Capital had taken a big hit in the ratings and the radar. And Richard called me and he said, you know, I'm going to do the impression. He said, dear boy, I believe you're having a bad time in your personal life. And I said, oh, that's nice of him. He's not so scared. I said, yes, Richard, it's true. Yes, my girlfriend and I have split up. And I started to tell him about it. And he went, no. He said, well, I'm sorry, it's going badly in your personal life because it's going really badly here. And I was like, oh, fucking hell. Oh, God. So he proceeded to tell me how bad my audience figures were. And that really, the only thing that the listeners at that time of the morning, and he was right, were interested in was a very, very soft. I think Richard Allinson had got it right. And the listeners really didn't want me being wacky. And I was, again, you know, making my own jingles. I was making my own comedy a cappella jingles, you know, the sort of the Chris Moyles type. In fact, Chris Moyles was on the Weekend Late Show at the same time as me. And I think we, he didn't want that. And so he gave me a real rollicking. And I said, well, listen, I know it's not right for that time of the morning. What about giving me a day part? So you can imagine how that went down. He didn't have to think about it for very long. But no, he actually did say to me, he said, look, do you think I'm going to replace Chris Tarrant with you? And I went, well, no. And he said, do you think I'm going to replace Steve Penk? I think Steve Penk had got himself an ITV Saturday Nightmares show. And he was massively famous because of this Tony Blair wind-up call with the brilliant John Coleshaw. And then, do you think I'm going to replace this one or that one or David Kidd Jensen? And I was like, no. He said, get out. And so that was it with that. And then, fortunately, shortly after, a guy called Dave Shearer, who, you'll know Dave Shearer. Have you met Dave, Foxy? Do you know Dave?
Dave, yes, I have. I've spent a night drinking with Dave, which...
that sounds right.
Yeah, as a lad from Hull, I can drink, but that was an education.
Yes.
And he has promised me that this year he will come on Crunch and Roll.
Oh, God, you've got to get him on. Yeah. He has got... If you thought my sponsored car story was amusing, Dave Shearer, look at me.
I've got it. I know it. I know it.
Yeah. I, it's not my story to tell, but that's arguably the funniest story I've ever heard about any other human.
Yeah,
that's coming in a future Crunch and Roll.
Great tease.
Yeah. So Dave Shearer, who I'd known, he was on Red Rose Gold when I was on Rock FM at the start of my career a few years earlier. He called me and he said, he used to call me Archie for no reason I can ever remember.
I was going to say, what was the reason for that?
I can't remember what it was. I think I once said to him that I liked the name Archie. And I think Scotty McClue's real name was Archie. And me and Scotty and Dave Shearer were out for some beers. Scotty McClue did the late night phone in and was just, again, a genius, or still is. And I said, I like the name Archie. And Shearer said, no, you don't. I said, no, I do. He said, fuck off. No, you don't. I said, no, I really like the name Archie. And so he then, I was just trying to be polite. No, I didn't really like the name Archie. And he then proceeded to call me Archie for the next, in fact, still calls me Archie now. So Dave Shearer called me and, Archie, listen, I hear it's not going so well at Capital. I was like, oh, great. No, it's not really. He said, listen, I've just taken over Q103. Do you fancy it? And I was like, are you kidding me? The idea of, you know, moving to Manchester, you know, and doing the breakfast show on the legendary Q103. I mean, Q103 was massive. I think Steve Penk had left about a year and a half earlier and Spence McDonald was doing a fine job of the show. I came up with my girlfriend at the time, the same girlfriend, by the way. We'd got back together by then.
Right, okay.
And I said, I'm glad we're back together. Do you fancy moving to Manchester? And she said, no. And I said, oh, go on. And she said, all right. And so we did. So we moved up to Manchester and then began the Q103 era.
Well, this is the big one for me because you are known as Mr. Key 103 in my eyes because you've been there for so long. I mean, you went straight onto breakfast at Key as well, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, incredibly. I started, at the same time England were in the World Cup in France, and I started, just that kind of exactly that time when David Beckham did the foul on whatever his name was, Diego thingy bob. So that was when I started on Key 103, and it was just I couldn't get over it again, honestly, Foxy. I was opening a microphone fader and going, "Good morning, Manchester," and it was like, "Wow, I'm really saying that, and there's really people listening." And amazingly, they let me employ one of my own school friends, a brilliant guy called Sean Gibson, as my producer, and he came up from Chelmsford in Essex, and he produced the show and did a great job. But it was just, during that time, I mean, I don't know. You look back on it now and it's just, it's nuts. We did the show from the Maldives, I think again with Steph Hurst, I think we did the show from Hong Kong, from the top of skyscrapers. We interviewed Tom Cruise, John Travolta, Jennifer Aniston. You know, it was just, the whole thing was everything, I'd ever dreamed that radio could be. And it was at a great time for Manchester as well. You had all these, these amazing bands, which obviously is still going, but you had, your Elbows and James and Oasis. When Oasis did their farewell gigs at the Etihad, it was Chelsea Norris, my co-host, and I, we were backstage with the Gallaghers. And it was just we did a gig with Ed Sheeran in Gail Platt's front room in Coronation Street Studios. Everything that I ever dreamed that doing a breakfast show in Manchester could have, Coronation Street, Man United. Beckham used to listen to the show. He used to phone us once a week and tell us we were talking crap about him. Alex Ferguson was on the show all the time. And it was just, it was just absolute golden.
Is it true that you went to Alex Ferguson's house?
God, you really are good. I feel really bad about my previous lack of BR&B knowledge. yes, I did. I used to host all of, and I still do, I think, although he's not done any for a while. I was lucky enough to get to know Fergie, and I've always been a lifelong Man United fan, and I got to host all his charity dues. And there was one time when I think I needed to pick up some papers from him. I can't remember what it was or why, but I needed to pick up some something from him, whatever it was. And his son, Jason, who's a friend of mine, said, "Well, let's just go around to the old man's house." I was like, "What?" So I took my son, Luca, at the age of, I think he must have been about six. And I just said, "Oh, I just need to pick up some papers." I picked Luca up from school. And he was a mad United fan and still is to this day. We're going on Saturday. And I didn't tell him where we were going. And I said, "I've got to pick up some papers." And we pulled up outside this house in Wilmslow. And it was just a normal house. It was a big house, but it wasn't, there weren't like electric gates or anything. And I just knocked on the door. Luca just came with me. And then Fergie opened the door. And, I could burst into another impression here, but it'll end up sounding like Richard Park. And he just said, come in. And we spent the whole evening at his house.
No.
Honestly. And he made, well, his wife, Kathy, God rest her. His wife, Kathy, made a shepherd's pie. We sat down and we watched, I think, like a West Ham game. We played a game of pool. He gave us a tour of the whole house. We flicked through. He owned the official autopsy for John F. Kennedy. I know, yeah, Fergie's got that. And I sat there literally flicking through it thinking, oh, this is interesting reading. And it was literally JFK. He owns JFK's autopsy and the Elephant Man's autopsy. If you're going to own an autopsy, I mean, either of those are pretty much top of the list, aren't they? So yeah, I had an evening at his house and it was just great. And Luca's face, I've still got the photo. It's one of the rare showbiz photos we've got in the house, Luca and him in his living room. But yeah, we had a wonderful evening. And he's just the nicest, warmest. He's a granddad figure. Well, he is. He's a great granddad, but he's just the warmest, nicest figure that you could ever come across.
I just want to talk about Key 103 because obviously you spent time at Capital, which for many people that was the ultimate dream. You then come to Key, which for me, for somebody from up north, that was the ultimate aim for me.
Yeah.
I knew very little about Capital. So speaking to Capital guests, like Brooksy and people like that, I find it hard to relate to that magic that they had for Capital. But the difference between Capital and Manchester, did you find I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but did you find the audience in Manchester were a bit more loyal?
Do you know, that's a great question. I think in Manchester, there's like a real partisan feeling towards everything Manchester. It's almost like a siege mentality that what we're doing in this city is great and the rest of the world can just do one. And I think they are massively proud of all the you know, the Manchester heritage things, you know, the football clubs, Coronation Street, you know, Boddington's, you know, and Key 103. And I think, you know, you could like Radio City in Liverpool. So the and also obviously it's smaller, isn't it? So compared to Capital, I think, Manchester is a third the size of London, but it still had everything. And it still does have everything. So if London's got 127 Turkish restaurants, you know, Manchester's got 30. So it had everything that you could possibly need. But everyone was very proud of the radio station as part of the city's heritage. You know, there've been so many great PR stunts. You know, James performing live with Pete and Jeff on the top of the Piccadilly Tower. There've been so many massive iconic things that had happened. The Gallaghers again on Pete and Jeff. You know, he basically discovered them. Or was one of the people, and so there's a massive loyalty that Mancunians had to Key 103, and also, you know, in terms of media, it was very different from you know being in London, because you got to know all the Coronation Street stars. You know, it's a smaller pool, so you would mix with, you know, not that I ever did particularly, but you would get to know footballers at charity events and Coronation Street stars at, you know, theatre premieres and stuff, and everyone got to know each other, you know, something again that, you know, JK and Joel sort of experienced a few years later on. Yeah. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time for the city and a wonderful time to be at Key 103.
I do want to come back to Key in just a second, but there is a question that I feel I need to ask. And if you don't want to answer it, that's absolutely fine. But of course, because I remember when JK and Joel left Viking, as a Viking person myself, just doing weekend overnights when they left, but I admired the two of them. I thought they were incredible. Andy Robson, of course, went to Key 103. We all knew what was going to happen. He was going to take them to that station in some capacity. Of course, he puts them on breakfast.
Mm.
He takes you off breakfast to do this.
I remember.
Yeah. Okay. But I've always thought, I mean, obviously they then leave to go to Radio 1 and then they put you back on breakfast. Were you pissed off?
The honest answer is yes. I think I think I was pissed off. I wasn't pissed off to be asked to go back on it. And I think, but I was pissed off to be taken off it, because I think we were certainly, you know, it was doing well. It was doing well. I think it was number one in Manchester. And then I had to go. And Andrew Robson, God bless him, I think he's at Radio Newcastle now.
He's at the BBC, yeah.
I think he did a thing. And yeah, I liked Andrew a lot. We were together at TFM. But he kind of did a thing where, you know, on air, when I had a month left on my breakfast show, and I had to say things like, coming soon, the breakfast show that Manchester's been waiting for. And I was like, oh, wow, you really want me to say that? All the sweepers were saying that while I was still on. And that was a bit of a kick in the clackers. And then when JK and Joel came, I think there was a policy where the station changed its name, was changed, and they probably did it Viking as well. The strap line became Feel the Noise, which I never really liked. I thought, well, firstly, it's an old 1970s bloody Slade song, and also noise is not a positive word to describe. So I don't know, you know, which genius came up with that, but it was the policy for the station when JK and Joel were there was that the rest of the station really just had to talk about either them or going out in Manchester. So Manchester nightlife. And I just thought, well, I don't really fit that. I think I'd just got married and we were trying for a baby and whatever. And I wasn't going out clubbing or going to the press club until 4 a.m. And I didn't have loads of stories about me being out on Deansgate locks. And I thought, so I can't, for example, I remember one stage, you know, Big Brother was launching and it was massive. And I said to Andy, listen, can we do a link about, he said, no, you know, the rule, you talk about JK and Joel's show or going out in Manchester. And I was like, oh, so for that, I was a bit pissed off. JK and Joel, when they first arrived, I suppose I had a resistance to, as you would do.
Yeah, you would. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's being honest. And they know that from me too. And I'm good friends, particularly with JK now. I don't see Joel as much anymore since he moved to Liverpool. But JK and I, you know, we speak. And I think, yeah, there was a resistance from me. But then I thought they were incredibly nice guys. I thought they were nuts. But they were good and they were talented. And they were what, you know, Key 103, I suppose, was about at the time. You know, they were a lot more raucous and probably a lot more real than me. Maybe at the time I was sort of a bit more of an announcer. And I was going, good morning, Manchester. I'm Mike Toolan. And it was all a bit squeaky clean. And they came along and you know, whatever, were farting on air. Whatever they did, no. But yeah, so I think there was resistance. But then I liked them, and I did. And then they went on to do really well. And they were always very nice with me. They did lots of stuff with me. So I'd come in on their show. So there was no real rivalry, I don't think, after a while.
Yeah.
I remember once... Joel on air gave me, when Viagra was invented, he gave me a Viagra pill to take on air and then played me a jam jingle montage and I was away. I could not control my arousal. What a combo. Yeah, that's true. Ask him about that. But yeah, and they're both doing brilliantly well now, you know. Yeah, they're both doing phenomenally well.
I had to ask Mike, I'm sorry.
No, mate, it's absolutely fine. It's a fair question, and I hope I've answered that honestly. That was
you have, yeah.
I was a bit peed off, yeah.
With that in mind, of course, you then go back on Breakfast for a zillion years.
Yeah.
Here's another question for you. Why were you so loyal to EMAP and Bauer when I'm guessing there were other opportunities?
Yeah, there's always been... said as always I'm not talking about the present moment. There's always been conversations that have gone on with me and Capital and Global and Heart and all this sort of stuff. So I don't know, I just loved Manchester, and I don't suppose, I suppose there is a loyalty. I mean, they've employed me there for I think it's 26 years now, so there certainly is that loyalty. Gary Steen is my big boss now, and he's just terrific. And he's been my boss for 1,000 years. And he's very, very good to me and always sort of looks after me. So I think the individual, you know, Paul Gerrard, the program controller of the Hits Radio Network, is still, you know, a great big, you know, supporter of what I do. And I think the individual relationship is more than a relationship to a company. I've seen everything that's happened, Foxy, as we all have in our industry over the last 10 years, and the demise of local stations. And like anyone, all that just makes me feel sad for all the individuals. And I can kind of see the logic. Well, of course I can. And how the world changes and evolves, and how, you know, radio needed to catch up with the digital thing, and how it's best, you know, serving its audiences now. But yeah, of course, the advancements of the networks, it's a really sad thing with what's happened to the industry, and I feel nothing but sympathy with a lot of people who've been, you know, left on shore.
I mean, we talk about your loyalty there to EMAP and to Bauer, but did you have any, you know, dreams of maybe Radio 1 or something like that?
Oh yeah, had I had the green light from Radio 1, I'd have been out of there like a shot. I mean, no, I did. I've never said this. I don't know if my bosses will be listening now. There was one point where I auditioned for the Radio 1 early show. And it was with Jeff Smith, who was number two at Radio 1 at the time. And I was at Capital. And I did an audition for it. And it got down to the last two. And it was me and Chris Moyles.
In
1998, and they gave the show to Chris Moyles. He was a lot better for more suited to Radio 1, obviously, as it proved. Yeah, he was very, very sort of real and earthy and authentic, and I was probably a bit sort of, again, a bit squeaky and polished.
I want to ask you about awards as well, because I ask many of my guests about the EMAPs or the Sonys. It's probably going to pain you when I say that Rossi's probably got the funniest story about Rick Horton, noddy holder and a towel.
Oh, shirt. Yes. In the room. I heard this on Crunch and Roll a few weeks ago.
Have you got any Sony stories, any EMAP stories you can share?
I mean, the EMAPs were just one massive piss fest, weren't they, Foxy? You remember, it was just a wonderful excuse for people to get And actually, yes, I do have a Sony story. Me and Joel, oh, that's going to sound really weird. I was going to say me and Joel Ross were in the toilet. That's not what I meant. We were in the toilets at the of the Grosvenor.
Let's just leave that one there. That's perfect.
We'll yeah, in fact, that's it. That's it. Why go on? That's the end of the story. No, Joel and I were in the toilets in the Grosvenor having a wee next to each other in the urinals, just to, for clarity. And I was listening. I remember I was chatting away with Joel and we were both absolutely ratted. And it was the Sony Awards and he was there with Radio 1 and I was there with Q103. And then all of a sudden I heard on the tannoy, because they pipe out the awards onto little speakers in the toilets. And I heard on the tannoy, I thought, hang on a minute, Joel, shut up. That's Chelsea. And it was Chelsea from The Breakfast Show on Q103. She was talking and she said, I could just hear her go, I've got no idea where Mike is. But and I was like, oh, shitting hell. And I literally, you know, sprinted, maybe with my Johnson still hanging. I sprinted down the massive spiral staircase of the Grosvenor and literally just completely out of breath. And I was pissed. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know we were even up for whatever award. And I did. I made it on the stage just before she walked off. And we'd won gold for something. And I literally took the microphone off and said, thanks, everyone. What have we won?
Is this going out or is it just in our headphones?
The hamster's fine.
It was a technical problem. You heard something on air you shouldn't have done.
Oh, yeah.
14 years on Breakfast once you replaced JK and Joel because the gaffer realised that you were better. I'm joking.
No, do that. And will you please send that to Joel?
Oh, he listens to everyone and I love
him. Oh, of course
he
does.
He knows I do.
Of course he does.
I want to talk about it because you've had several co-hosts. You've had Chelsea. This is the list I've got. Chelsea, yeah. Gemma Atkinson, of course, Kelly Pegg. I mean, you know, you've been there, the stability whilst people have been coming in and out around you with like a revolving door. I mean, did you find it easy to change with different co-hosts? Because I know I've been really fortunate to have two amazing guys, Tom and Juliana, with me in my career. And then Emma Jones, of course, has gone to do amazing things. I've also done shows with people I didn't get on with. Yeah. And I found that horrible.
Yeah. Oh, there's nothing worse, is there, than doing a show with someone you don't get on with? I think when Chelsea and I had a really good run, and I think we did it together for 11 years. And then they decided to move things on. And I think at the time she was quite annoyed. In fact, I know at the time she was quite annoyed with that and made her feelings quite clear to anyone who'd listen. And again, we're really good friends again now. But it's never been my decision, as you'll know, Foxy, who you can sometimes have a say in it, but it's never been my decision as to who was the co-host. I didn't, you know, I when Chelsea had gone, I was very happy to get Gemma Atkinson along. But yeah, it's you just make the best of it, don't you? And I think that, you know, any programmer would be a bit daft to throw together two people who, you know, had no chemistry. So I've always been quite lucky. There's always been a chemistry from the start. Gemma Atkinson and I, for example, were we met years ago in a pantomime. And we were really, really good friends. So, you know, there's the chemistry already there. But yeah, no, it would certainly be rather unpleasant to get stuck with someone who you had no chemistry with.
Well, of course, now Hits Radio across the network. Are you still enjoying it as much as you did back in the day?
Do you know, I a lot of people ask me this and people say to me, oh, well, you know, I used to love Q103 and I genuinely am, but purely for selfish reasons. And I genuinely, I know it was my Catholic upbringing, John, but I genuinely feel really guilty. And I do for how many casualties there've been in the last few years for radio. I feel it's awful. And for me, it's a bit like, what was that Pamploma festival where they do the running of the bulls, you know, where they release all these bulls and all these villagers just like peg it. And that is my analogy for how my radio career has been. I'm just still running, but I'll see this one. Oh, he's got a horn up his ass. Oh, this one's been trampled on. And somehow, I don't know how, I keep running, but at some point the bull will catch me. And I'm fully aware of that. And you know, I have no disillusions about ever feeling. I don't. None of us have got a divine right to be on air our whole lives. And I said this to Chelsea when they They let her go back in 2000 and whatever it was, 16. You know, none of us have got a divine right to be on. You know, it's an employment, it's a contract. And, you know, when your face doesn't fit anymore, as it has done with me a couple of times, you know, they let you go. I'm still really, really lucky. I think I've been working with Gemma Atkinson on the Drive show for a couple of years, and she is like my best friend. Our producer is a guy. Have you heard of a guy called Matt Foister? Have you come across him?
Yes. He was on Hallam.
Yes, he was. And he, I mean, well, he's like, I talked about the, you know, some of the casualties. He is a brilliant broadcaster, and he's an excellent DJ, and he's producing at the minute, and he's so wonderful at it. You know, but I know, you know, he could do the show himself, and he gives me lines, and I feel incredibly sort of guilty. He gives me lines and makes me or Gemma Atkinson, you know, funnier. And he's very, very generous with himself, and he's a brilliant producer, but he was also a brilliant jock. But, you know, he's producing me now, and I love him dearly. And then Gemma Atkinson is one of my best friends. And then Gemma's gone off on maternity leave, but comes back next month. And so for the last sort of 9 months, we've had Brooke Vincent, who was Sophie Webster on Coronation Street. And again, an old friend, and she's just brilliant. So in that room, the three of us, if the chemistry is good, you're enjoying it, you know, which I really do still do. And I hope it sort of comes across. I mean, we just genuinely do have with Brooke and with Gemma, just a really, really good laugh.
What's the highlight of your career so far?
It's this.
Yeah.
It was when
okay,
I forgot
second.
It was when I forgot you're on BRMB.
No, Mike, it's not that you forgot. It's because you didn't know. That's the most painful thing, I think.
God, I know. I did know, obviously.
Can I just say it as well, Mike? One thing I've realized having chatted to you for the last however long is that I wasn't aware of this, but you are an anorak.
Oh, massively. Oh,
so,
God.
So that actually, you've actually stuck the knife in there, Mike, and twisted it right round knowing that I was on BRMB. I mean, for being such a big
years.
Anorak.
What happened? What happened?
It was longer than that. I think it was longer than for you. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've forgotten your last question, actually, John. Sorry, I took us off down.
I was asking, you said it was doing Crunch and Roll, but what is your biggest highlight for you?
I think personally, God, I mean, there's just been so many, but it probably was, as I said earlier, I was a Man United, well, I am a Man United fan, even though we're largely shit these days. it was probably hosting the treble winning party at the Manchester Arena. So this was 1999. I'd only been on Key 103 for a year, and somehow I think they had us on in the Carrington, the training ground, and I don't know how it all came about, but I got the phone call. Man United were on course to do the treble in the May of 1999. They'd won the Premier League, they'd won the FA Cup, and then they were in the Champions League final. Against Bayern Munich, and someone had said to me, someone had called from Man United, and they said, right, listen, if they win the treble, there's going to be a massive homecoming parade through the streets of Manchester, and then there's going to be a big party with all the team and Fergie and everyone on stage at the Manchester Arena, and we would like you to host it. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? That's absurd. And so sure enough, they won the treble, and then the very next day, I hosted and I had no idea how big it was going to be. It was literally, I arrived and it was live on ITV, and the cameras were live at the spot I was going to stand on, and there were, you know, and I was aware, I just stood there. It was live on BBC Five Live. It was live on ITV. It was live on, it was at Sky News, literally feed of the thing. And all of a sudden I had the world's media on me, and I had to, you know, bring on Beckham and Giggsy and the Nevilles and Scholesy and Fergie and interview them live on TV. And I was absolutely crapping it. But by the end of it, I thought, wow. And actually, ever since then, to be honest, Foxy, I don't know, the other guys listening to this can kind of relate to this, but once you've done a really scary gig, after that, slightly smaller gigs are okay, because you think, yes, I've done that. So I know if I can do that, if I can do a thing in front of 15,000 people and it's live on TV, surely I can host, you know, Berry's Got Talent.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being on Crunch and Roll. Has it been as painful as you thought?
It's been an absolute joy, honestly. And like I said, I've listened to this podcast for a year or so. And no, it's a massive honor to be on it. And Foxy, it's lovely to properly meet you, buddy.
Well, thank you very much. We shall beer together at some point, hopefully.
Yeah, we will. Get Steph to sort it. She's good at that stuff.
She's amazing. Well, I'm guessing you've done voiceover work, Mike. Where can we hear your voice?
I think you'll find I did Blockbuster, Bringing Entertainment Home. And
is that Wrigley, you?
That was me. Yes. And Wrigley's for the great taste of a mint. There we are.
Well, we are honoured. Listen, thank you so much. Can you please take us home with the end credits?
I certainly can. You've been listening to Crunch and Roll with me, Mike Toolan. Subscribe on your favourite podcast app to get every new episode as soon as they drop. Crunch and Roll is a 969 Media production, presented by John Fox and produced by Simon Borowski.
Oh, yeah.